So let's spend a minute cultivating our motivation and rejoicing that we have the opportunity to listen to the Buddha's precious teachings, and that we have a precious human life with all the conditions necessary to learn and practice those teachings. And let's make a determination to use our life in a meaningful way. So there's various ways to make our life meaningful, but the best way is by cultivating the bodhicitta, the altruistic intention, aspiring for full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So let's hold that very noble aspiration really dear in our hearts, and make that our intention for listening to the teachings tonight. Okay. So we left off last time in the section that was called Death and the Lower Realms. We were had concluded everything through Aryanagarjuna's quote about he ends it saying, human life is rare and precious, do not make it a cause of pain, take heed, use it well. So here he is warning us about the danger of having an unfortunate rebirth. Now, some of us may not be completely convinced that rebirth is possible to begin with. So let's talk a little bit about that, because the third Dalai Lama here assumes that he's talking to people who have some conviction in the existence of rebirth, which was true with a Tibetan audience at the time that he lived, but it's certainly not true for us. Okay. So, how does rebirth work? Well, first of all, we have a body and a mind, and these are different continuum. The body is made of atoms and molecules. It can be measured by scientific instruments. Okay, it can be touched and heard and seen and smelled. But our mind, our consciousness, is not made of atoms and molecules. It's not form. It's something that is clear in the sense of being formless, and also clear in the sense of being able to reflect objects. And it's also aware in that it's able to engage with objects. So the mind is not something that can be measured by scientific instruments. Now, you might say, but wait a minute, all these neuroscientists are finding areas of the brain that correspond with our emotions, and they can measure what's going on in these areas of the brain. So can't they perceive our mind? Well, there's a difference between the brain and the mind. You know, the brain is the physical organ, but the brain itself does not cognize or perceive or experience. For example, we might have certain chemical or electrical phenomena going on in our brain that scientists can perceive. But do those chemicals have consciousness? Do they experience pain and pleasure? Okay. Do the brain cells cognize phenomena, or are they only a physical organ that enables the mind to actually cognize and experience phenomena? In other words, if you look at certain cells in a petri dish, let's say, and they're having certain chemical reactions or electrical firings, Can we look at that and say that is anger or that is happiness? I don't think so, because anger, happiness, love, experience, all these things happen in the mind. They aren't something that you can look at and say that a bunch of chemicals or cells are experiencing. Yeah? So we have to really differentiate between our mind and the brain. I remember at one science conference many years ago with His Holiness, there was one scientist who was very adamant that the mind is the brain, and that you couldn't talk about the mind apart from the brain. And so His Holiness asked him, if you took somebody's brain, let's say you could take a living brain, a brain in which there were, chemical and electrical things going on, and put it on a table, okay, would you look at that brain and say that's a person? I don't think so. Yeah? Would you accept that brain into graduate school and give it a degree? I don't think so. Would you marry that brain? Would two brains stand side by side and get married? When you care about a person and you say they have a kind heart, and you love them, do you love their brain? No? So when we look at it this way, we see that, the brain does one thing, but it's not capable of doing everything. Okay? So it's interesting to look at just in our experience when we sit and meditate, when we're meditating and let's say we're watching our breath, to ask ourselves, what is it that is experiencing the breath? Now, when we're sitting there experiencing the in and out breath, do we feel like it's our brain? Or do we feel, no, it's my mind, that there's something that is cognizant there that actually apprehends things, okay? One time at one of these science conferences, I asked one of the scientists, because he had been doing a lot of research about brain functions during emotions, and I said to him, because he was able to see that the brain does this and that, certain parts of the brain have certain reactions when we're angry. And I said, well, when you're angry, okay, let's say you get angry at somebody in your life, do you just think, oh, it's my synapses in my brain firing in a certain way? And do you use that as a reason to calm yourself down, just saying, well, it's just the synapses firing. There's no other anger besides the synapses. So he looked at me and he said, no. So it was quite interesting because he was doing all this research, but none of it was actually he couldn't apply it to his experience, Because, when we're happy, we don't feel like it's just our brain cells firing in a certain way. And when we're full of holding a grudge and we're resentful, we don't feel like it's just, a certain part of our brain having certain chemical reactions. Okay? So here we see that the body, including the brain, is one thing, but the mind is something else. When they're together, that's what we call being alive. But when they separate at the time of death, they each have their own continuum. So the body gets recycled in nature. Okay, it gets burnt, it gets buried. The worms have a nice banquet. Yeah, but the mind goes on. It continues. It doesn't cease just because the body has ceased. And instead, the mind goes on and it takes another life, at least for ordinary beings. And the life it takes is conditioned or influenced by the actions that we've done. You know, what we've thought and felt and said and done, you know, physically. Mm-hmm. So it's, where the mind is attracted for rebirth is conditioned by things in this life and also things in previous lives. Okay, so here we can, you know, get some idea that mind and body are a little bit different. Another way to think about it is we can think, well, the body has its causes, okay? We can track the body back. You know, our body today is a result of our body from yesterday and, you know, the day before, and it's a continuation of the body from when we were an infant and from, you know, when we were a fetus and an embryo and so on. And then the continuity of the body is traced back to the sperm and egg of our parents, things like that. There's some material continuity there. Now, when we trace our mind back, okay, our mind of today is a continuation of the mind of yesterday. Okay, so we can think about what we were thinking and feeling about yesterday. And then that's a continuation of the day before and the day before. And so, you know, we see that there's some mental continuation. So we can remember thinking certain things. We can remember different events in our life. We might get to a certain point in our memory where we can't remember things earlier. We may not remember when we were 1 year old, for example. But we do know that an infant at 1 year has a mind, because we can look at other infants and see that they cognize an experience. Okay? So even if we can't remember, we can see that infants do have a mind. And then that mind also is a continuation from the mind that we had when we were in our mother's womb. You know, babies in the womb experience things, you know. The mother moves in certain ways, the babies experience it. And so the mind in the womb can be traced back to the first moment of mind that is usually said to enter the fertilized egg, the combination of the egg and the sperm, at the time of conception. Now, where did that mind come from, that mind that entered into the sperm and egg? Well, it also had its continuity. And the only thing we can point to is a preceding moment of mind. So that was a moment of mind in a previous life before the consciousness joined with this life. And then so on, back and back and back. There's an infinite continuity of the mind without any beginning, because each moment of mind arose from a previous moment of mind, which was its cause. So there was no first beginning. Okay? So Buddhism is very different than theistic religions, where there was a first beginning. Instead, we say a first beginning is impossible. Okay? Because everything has to have a cause, and if there was a cause, then there was something before it. So, and then the cause had a cause, and the cause of the cause had a cause, and, you know, you never find any absolute beginning. So, thinking about rebirth in a logical way like this, we can get some idea of how rebirth functions, that everything has to have a cause, the body has its cause, the mind has its cause. What's the cause of the mind? The previous moment of mind. What's the effect of our present moment of mind? A future moment of mind. Okay? So that's one way to understand how rebirth can exist, how there's a continuity of consciousness from one life to the next. Just because we can't remember what our previous life was doesn't mean it didn't happen. Okay? Can you remember what you ate for breakfast 3 years ago last Tuesday? I don't know about you, but I can't. But, you know, that event happened, So I can't say just because I don't remember it that it doesn't exist. It never happened. I mean, our memories just are not very good. There are some people that can remember previous lives. If you watch the movie Kundun, that talks about how they found the present Dalai Lama, it shows how he, as a child, you know, had memories of his previous life. He was able to remember people. He was able to remember objects. Yeah. So that we see that there's a continuity of memory when the mind is very, very clear. They say that when the search party came to look for the present Dalai Lama, he was a young child. And even as a young child, he was able to identify the prayer beads from his previous life, and he was able to identify the monk who was dressed up as the guy who took care of the animals. He was able to recognize him because he had known him from his previous life. So this kind of thing can happen. I was once I gave a talk about rebirth at a community, at a library in Florida many years ago. And afterwards, a woman came up to me and she said, "Oh, that was so interesting hearing about rebirth because I think I understand my son much better. Nobody in our family was musically inclined, but my son, from the time he was very little, whenever he got in a car and there was some classical music playing, he could identify what it was. You know, this is Beethoven's symphony number blah blah, and this is Chopin's number this and that." And he said nobody else knew, but somehow he knew that. So if I think about it in terms of rebirth and him having some memory from a previous life, then it makes sense. And I remember one time when I was teaching in Tonali, you know, some of you may have been there, Pato, I think that you were there at that course, and there was a documentary that was shown in Spanish, because I remember you translated it into English for me. And there were some interviews then with people who had memories of their previous life. So it might be good to see if you can find that video and show it at the Dharma Center. It was really fascinating just to see how ordinary people, you know, with, for whatever reason, either clarity of mind or karma, could remember different things from their previous life. It was fascinating to watch this. And these people weren't Buddhists. They weren't people who were brought up with a view of previous lives. But they just were able to remember. And some of their memories were able to be confirmed. There was one woman who, ever since she could remember when she was little, she remembered some village in England. And when she was an adult, she went back there. And she had remembered her name from her previous life, different events from her previous life. She remembered her children, you know, their names. So when she was an adult and she found that village and went back there, she met her previous life's son, who was now an old man. And she would talk about memories that she had of her previous life, and her son authenticated those memories because he remembered the same things from when he was a kid. Yeah, it was really fascinating to watch this. Okay, so this kind of thing, you know, when we think, you know, hear of other people who do have previous lives memories, then that might give us some kind of confidence in the existence of rebirth. So if you don't have a full conviction in rebirth, what you can do is accept it temporarily, kind of accept it provisionally, and then see if it helps explain things in your life. Okay? So just say, okay, well, if I believe in rebirth, then, you know, could that explain certain events that have happened in my life? You know? For example, for me, you know, I remember as a children, I was thinking about all sorts of things that my parents never taught me and that nobody ever taught me. And, you know, and if I look at my own life, you know, how was it that I became a Buddhist nun? You know, it certainly wasn't anything genetic. There are no Buddhists in my genealogy. You know, when I was growing up, I didn't learn anything about Buddhism. And yet, when I encountered the Buddhist teachings, they made sense to me. Now, how come they made sense to me? How about you? You know, you encountered Buddhist teachings. You grew up in Mexico or the U.S. and didn't, you know anything about rebirth or Buddhist teachings when you were growing up, and yet you hear them now, and you go, oh, that makes sense, that helps. Well, why is that? Why do you have that feeling of affiliation? I think it could be because in previous lives, you know, we may have known something about the Dharma. There is some familiarity. And so when we hear it this life, you know, something clicks, something makes sense about it. Okay? So just play with this idea of rebirth and see, you know, if you accept it, if it can, you know, help you understand yourself or understand different things that you see in the world around you. Okay, so if rebirth exists, you know, and even if we just accept it provisionally, then that really changes our perspective on life. Because what it means is that after death, the mind continues. Okay? So it means that, you know, at the time of death, it's not that we just go into complete non-existence and there's just nothingness, no consciousness, no awareness, no person, nothing after we die. You know, it means that there's a continuity of consciousness and, you know, that person in the future, you know, that exists by being merely labeled in dependence upon that consciousness, you know, that person is going to want happiness. Now, you might say, well, that person's not me. Okay. Well, imagine being 80 years old. Okay. Let's say you live to be 80 years old. Is that person you? Is that person the same as the person you are right now? Yeah. When you look at your baby picture, is that you? We look at the baby picture. We say, oh, that's me. But what about that baby is me? Yeah, if you show your baby picture to somebody and mix it in with a bunch of other babies, can somebody else pick out which baby is you? I don't think so. All the babies look pretty much alike. We have the same hairdo. Okay? Very difficult to just look at a baby and see who it is. So, because our body now is very different than the baby's body. What you were thinking about, the baby's mind, is that your mind now? It's different, isn't it? Okay. But we say, we look back to that baby and we say, that's me. We look ahead to the person who's going to be 80 years old and we say, that's me. But actually, the body and the mind of the infant and the elder person are not our present body and mind. But we still say, that's me. Okay? Why? Because there's some kind of continuity there. Now, it's true when we go from this life to the future life, there's no continuity of our body. Okay, this body ceases and we get a whole new body. But there is the continuity of the mind. Okay, and that's what allows for certain people to remember their previous lives. So because there's this continuity of mind, there's going to be a person who is merely labeled in dependence upon that mind of the future life. Okay? Or there's going to be a person who's merely labeled independence upon the mind of the 80-year-old body. Okay? So that person wants to be happy, don't they? Okay? And we know that. We accept that. How come? Because we work very hard for the happiness of the person we're going to be in old age. Okay? We have no idea how long we're going to live. We don't know if we're going to live to be 80 years old. But we make preparations for it. Okay? We work hard now. We save up money. We do all sorts of things because we know that that 80-year-old person wants to be happy. So we create the worldly causes for that person's happiness right now. Well, if we just go beyond this life and think of the person we're going to be in a future life, they're also going to want a happiness. So why shouldn't we prepare for the happiness of that person that we're going to be in the future life? If we work for the happiness of the 80-year-old, and that 80-year-old may not even exist because we may die first, but the future life person is definitely going to exist. So why not work for the happiness of that future life person? Okay? So that's important to think about and important to do. Okay? We look now and we can see that we have so much good fortune in our present life. Yeah? I mean, we live in a comparatively peaceful place. We have enough food. We have shelter. We have friends, we have people who care about us. Sure, we have problems, but we have a lot of good things going for us. Okay? This is because of virtuous activities that we did in a previous life. Okay? So whoever we were in a previous life did a lot of good things that enable the person who we are now to reap the benefit. Okay? Now we might think, well, that person wasn't me. Well, in one way it wasn't us, because it's not the same person that we are now. My previous life is not children. Children is just the name for this life. But there is a general I, you know, that exists by being merely labeled in dependence upon whatever aggregates there were. So the I who I was in a previous life, that person did something pretty good. I'm very grateful to whoever that person was. Because as a result, I have a very good life now. Yeah? So I can't remember that previous life, but, you know, somebody really did something then. So maybe I should be kind to the future me and create some good karma now. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay? And so when we have this belief in future lives, then it comes with some sort of belief in karma, in cause and effect, and an understanding that our actions have results. And the results of our actions, some of them may happen immediately after the actions, but some of them may not happen until a future life. And some of what we do now may ripen in the next life, and some of what we do now may not ripen for many, many lifetimes. Okay? But those actions, those karmas, the seeds or the latencies that are created by them, they continue along with us until they meet the proper circumstances, and then they ripen in terms of, you know, the body and mind, the five aggregates that we take. They ripen in terms of what experiences we encounter in our life. They ripen in terms of what kind of habitual behavior we have, what kind of habitual personality traits we have. Our actions ripen in terms of the environment that we're born in. Okay? So when we really think deeply about this, then we begin to care about, you know, what's going to happen to us in the future life. And when we do that, then that makes us be much more attentive to keeping good ethical conduct right now. Because we know that there's a link between our actions of body, speech, and mind now and what we're going to experience in a future life. So we become much more attentive of our actions now. As we become more attentive to our present actions, you know, then we're also willing to apply the antidotes to attachment, resentment, all these disturbing mental factors that make us create negative karma. By applying the antidotes to this attachment and aversion and confusion, then we actually improve the quality of this life and we begin to be able to live in the present moment in a lot better way. Okay? Okay, so let's go back to the text and see what else the third Dalai Lama says here. Because he was quoting Nagarjuna, who talked about the different experiences in the lower realms of existence. And one is born in these lower realms due to non-virtuous actions, non-virtuous karma. Okay, in other words, killing, stealing, unwise sexual behavior, okay, those three physical actions. And then four verbal actions, lying, creating disharmony, harsh speech, and idle talk. And three mental actions, coveting, ill will, and distorted views. Okay. So the third Dalai Lama says, as Nagarjuna implies, the sufferings of the hot and cold hells are unendurable. The sufferings of hungry ghosts are horrendous. And the sufferings of animals, eating one another, being domesticated and ruled by humans, being dumb, and so forth, are overwhelming. Right now, you cannot hold your hand in fire for even a few seconds. You cannot sit naked on ice in the winter for more than a few minutes. To pass even a single day without eating or drinking anything brings great difficulty. And merely a tiny bee sting seems terrible. How then will you be able to bear the heat or cold of the hells, the anguish of the hungry ghosts, or the horrors of animal existence? Meditate on the sufferings of the lower realms until you are filled with dread and apprehension. Now that you have gained an auspicious human form, abandon the causes of lower rebirth and cultivate the causes of a happy rebirth. Determine to apply yourself to the methods that cut off the path to the lower realms. Okay, so here he's asking us to look at our experience and how able are we to endure suffering. We always feel we're very brave, okay? But, you know, can we stick our hand in fire? No. So if we are born in the hot hells where there's constant burning, will we be able to endure that? Okay? When we're outside in the winter without a sweater for a long period of time, the pain is really bad. So would we be able to bear the pain of the freezing cold hells? Okay. Now remember here that these hell realms are not eternal. They're not like the Christian hells. We're only born in these experiences due to the causal energy of our negative karma. When that causal energy is exhausted, okay, when we've had enough of that experience that has been caused by our actions, then birth in those particular lower realms ceases. We die from those births and we take rebirth in another life. Okay, so these are not, you know, things that last forever. And also, they are not places that we are sent to because we're being punished by our negative deeds. Okay? The Buddha is not punishing us for our harmful actions. In fact, the Buddha has more compassion for us than we have for ourselves. And if the Buddha could remove our negative karma and prevent us from being born in these lower realms, he would certainly do that. But the thing is that the karma, that's actions that we ourselves have done. So the seeds are implanted on our own mind. The Buddha cannot reach into our own mind and pull out those negative karmic seeds like somebody else can reach and pull a thorn out from our foot. You know, if we step on a thorn or a rusty nail, somebody can reach down and pull it out for us. But something like karmic seeds that cannot be seen or touched, nobody can reach into our mental continuum and pull them out. And nobody else can create them either and put them in our mind stream. So our karma is created by ourself, and it's purified by ourself. Okay? And so for that reason, these lower rebirths are not punishments at all. They're just results of our own actions. Okay? Similarly, when we have a positive rebirth, they're not rewards. They're just results of the actions that we've ourselves have created. So today at the Abbey, Nance and Sangeeta were planting the garden. So what did you plant today?
Carrots. And lettuce.
Cauliflower.
So they planted carrots and lettuce and cauliflower. Okay? So the carrot seeds, yeah, planting carrot seeds are going to give carrots as a result. You're not going to grow roses when you plant carrots. Okay? When you plant cauliflower, you get cauliflowers. You don't get jalapenos, okay? When you plant jalapeno seeds, you don't get string beans. You get jalapenos. So similarly, when we plant negative karma, we don't get happiness. Yeah? When we plant positive karma, karmic seeds in our mind, we don't get suffering. Yeah? It's just a causal relationship between the kind of cause and the kind of result. So it has nothing to do with any kind of external agent or any kind of God or external being rewarding and punishing us. It has nothing to do with that. It's simply we create the causes and we experience the results. That's it. Okay? So what that means is that we are responsible for what happens to us. Now that's good, okay, in the sense that we're responsible. So that means that our happiness does not depend on placating or propitiating or pleasing some kind of external god or external ruler or external, you know, somebody. Okay? It doesn't, our being happy and free of suffering doesn't depend on some other being who is more powerful and pleasing them and hoping that they like us. Okay? Instead, our future happiness depends on our own actions. Okay? So that means we have the power and the ability to create the kind of future that we want to experience. Okay? What that also means is that we can't blame other people for our misery, because we're the ones who are responsible. So we can't, when we have problems, say, oh, so-and-so sent me this problem, or so-and-so caused me this problem, or it's not my fault, I didn't do anything. Okay? Because whenever we have a problem, we're the ones who created the result, the cause, so we have to bear the responsibility for that. But when we become more and more aware of this in our life, then bearing that responsibility becomes easier, and we really put more joyous effort into creating the causes for happiness and abandoning the causes of suffering. Okay, so today they planted carrots because we wanted carrots, and they planted cauliflower because we want cauliflower, and they didn't plant jalapenos. But maybe you're going to plant jalapenos because you like those. Okay? But in any case, we're the ones who are responsible for the garden that we grow. Yeah. So there are some things that you can hire somebody else to do for you. Okay? You can hire somebody to clean your house. You can hire somebody to drive you somewhere in the car. You can hire somebody to mow the lawn, okay? But can you hire somebody to eat for you so that you won't feel hungry? Okay? Can you ask somebody else to sleep for you so that you won't feel tired? I think that would be really nice. You know, I have so many things I want to do, and getting tired gets in the way. It'd be so nice, you know, if you could just say to somebody, oh, hey, you know, can you just sleep for me so I stop feeling so tired? I think that would be great, yeah? But it doesn't work that way. There's some things we have to do for ourselves, like eating and sleeping. And creating good karma is one of those. We have to do it for ourselves. We can't hire somebody else to do it. We can't ask somebody else to do it for us. We have to change our own body, speech, and mind. Okay? So when we see the sufferings of the hell realms, for example, that gives us a lot of energy to change our mental, verbal, and physical actions. Okay? It makes us more aware. Similarly, when we think of the sufferings that the hungry ghosts go through, that they experience so much hunger and so much thirst as a result of their miserliness and their stinginess, okay, then we think, oh, well, how do I feel when I don't have enough to eat? Pretty lousy. You know, do I want to be born in a realm where there's this constant frustration of not having enough to eat? No. How am I going to avoid being born in that realm? By being generous, by sharing food, okay? Offering food to others, making offerings in general. Okay? Sometimes we look at animals and we say, oh, animals have it so easy. They don't have to pay taxes. They don't have to go to work and work at a job. Yeah? They just, we look at our pet kitties, we look at our dogs, you know, and we're their servants, okay? Our pets have servants, you know, we are very dutiful employees of our pets. We feed our dogs very well when they bark. We, you know, feed our cats when they meow, when they complain. So we might say, well, an animal rebirth isn't so bad. But think about it a little more, okay? There are a lot of animals who are exploited by human beings. Okay, if you eat meat, think of the cow or the pig or the deer or the chicken or the fish that you ate for lunch, okay? Would you like to be born as that kind of animal that is reared in a farm for human consumption and then brought to the slaughterhouse and killed so that somebody could eat you for lunch? Okay, think about that, because that helps us see that animal rebirth is not completely great. Yeah. When I go to India, something that really, really touches me is they have a lot of donkeys there. And, you know, the donkeys, it's like you can look at them and, you know, they're sentient beings. They're alive. They feel, you know, you can tell there's some consciousness there. but they can't express themselves, and they completely are at the whims of the human beings who use them. And these donkeys have sacks on their back that the human beings put so much gravel in, they put slate in it, you know, and then they beat the donkeys to make them carry the gravel or the slate uphill, and then they use those things to build the houses that the human beings live in. And I always feel so terrible when, you know, I see the donkeys, because they have no freedom, and I'm sure it's like miserable carrying all that stuff and being beaten, and you're tired and you're hungry. The owners don't care. They just beat you some more because they're making money and they want the gravel and the slate moved. Okay? Or even, you know, we look at our pets and we say, you know, I'm looking at my kitties right now and they're just sleeping. You know? Maybe some of you are sleeping through this teaching also. Actually, one of the kitties just woke up when I said that. He's looking at me. Oh, now he's going back to sleep. Okay. So, you know, so you might say, oh, you just sleep all day. But there you have a consciousness, and you can't do anything useful with your consciousness. Yeah? You can't steer your mind and deliberately cultivate love and compassion. You can't work on your mind and create joy. When the kitties are sick and I have to take them to the vet, the veterinarian, they're terrified. You know, they're so afraid. And I try to explain that they don't need to be afraid, that they're going to go to the doctor who's going to help make them better, but they can't understand. And so they're frightened unnecessarily. They don't need to be afraid, but because they're ignorant and they don't have the faculty to use language, then they experience so much suffering. They like to go outside. It's springtime, and they like to chase the chipmunks and the voles and the gophers and the mice that are in the garden. And we try and tell them, you know, don't chase those other living beings, because the chipmunks, the mice, the voles, the gophers, they all want to live just as much as you want to live. They don't want to die. But the kitties don't understand. You know, we try and teach them just about the first precept of not killing. And they look at us and they don't understand one word. And they go right out into the garden and chase the first chipmunk that they see, hoping to catch it and play with it and chew on it a little bit. You know, because they don't understand. So do we want to be born with that kind of ignorance? Do we want to be born where other beings have control over us in that way, where we cannot really understand the Dharma and think for ourselves? So if we spend some time really thinking about what it would be like to be born in these other realms, that generates within us, you know, some very strong intention to keep really good ethical conduct, because we don't desire those kinds of rebirths. When the third Dalai Lama here says to meditate on the lower realms and their sufferings until you are filled with dread and apprehension, he doesn't mean that we think of those sufferings and then we get terrified. You know, maybe when you were a little kid and the priest told you, you know, that if you stole your brother's chewing gum, you were going to hell. You know, you got really scared and afraid and you cried and whimpered because you were a child who was terrified. The Dalai Lama is not talking about creating that kind of mental state, okay? Because clearly having that very that mental state full of that kind of fear and panic, that is not a healthy mental state. And that mental state isn't very conducive to creating positive karma. So when it says to cultivate fear or dread or apprehension, it's talking about a certain kind of wisdom fear. Okay? For example, when you are getting on the highway, do you have an awareness of the danger of all these cars are rushing past you on the highway? You're just pulling on, you have to merge with the traffic that's already there. Do you have an awareness of the danger that's there? Yeah, you do. We're aware. Oh, this is a potentially dangerous situation, so I've got to concentrate when I enter the highway and merge with the traffic. But you aren't all full of fear and panic and neurosis and that kind of stuff. But you do have an awareness of potential danger. And so due to that awareness, then you take precautions so that you don't, just pull over and bump into another car who's driving 60 miles an hour. Okay. So in the same way, when we think about the sufferings of the lower realms, we don't want to get neurotic, but we are aware that there's some potential danger there. And so as a result, we take precautions right now to not create the causes for that kind of dangerous situation to ripen on us. Okay? So that kind of awareness of danger is something useful. Okay? It's, for example, some of you are parents and you tell your children about the danger of taking drugs. Okay? And you tell them about how people get out of control and then they do all sorts of stupid things, or they jump off buildings, or they use dirty needles, or they, you tell them about the suffering that comes from drug addiction. Your reason for doing that is so that your child gets some awareness of the potential suffering that they could experience if they do something unwise. Okay? You're not trying to make your child neurotic and panicky, but you're trying to make them aware of danger so that they take special methods now and don't hang out around other people who take drugs or who do dangerous things. So in a similar way, the Buddha is talking about these realms so that we have that information so that we can, use our wisdom now and avoid creating the causes for those kinds of suffering. But we don't want to get all panicky and scared and, like children do. That's not the purpose of this meditation. Okay? And so the third Dalai Lama concludes this section by saying, now that you have gained an auspicious human form, abandon the causes of lower rebirth and cultivate the causes of a happy rebirth. So that's the main message he's trying to get across to us. And then he says, determine to apply yourself to the methods that cut off the path to the lower realms. Okay? So trying to get us to make a very firm determination to really do the Dharma practices that cease the causes of the lower realms and that purify any causes for lower rebirth that we may have created already.